It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Investigative journalists at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel have published an analysis of immigration arrests in Wisconsin from September 2023 through last month. They looked at newly released data from the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. It's data they couldn't get from ICE earlier this year. The numbers show that arrests have more than doubled since President Trump took office in January, with more dramatic changes in arrests as recently as last month, especially among immigrants without criminal convictions. To learn more, we're joined by Eva Wen, data reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's investigations team. And Gina Lee Castro is here, public investigator reporter, co-writing the article with Eva. Eva and Gina, welcome to you both.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Eva, let's start with you. I understand you made the initial records requests to ICE. What happened when you asked them to share the data?
So they claim that they do not track the data by the state level. So instead, they have data for our region, which is governed by Chicago. So that's what they pointed me to. But at the time I made the arrest or I made the records request, I was aware that there were several lawsuits going on that were looking for state level data.
How did you eventually get a hold of arrest records from ICE looking at Wisconsin?
So that came out as a result of one of those lawsuits, which is brought against ICE by the University of California, Los Angeles, and University of California, Berkeley. And they were able to sue ICE. And, you know, after ICE acknowledged that they do have that data, released that data, they were able to post that data online for public access.
And this data was in a format that you could, you know, organize. It was clean, as they would say in data science, that you could work with?
I think nothing is perfectly clean ever, but, you know, it had the unique identifier for each individual without, you know, identifying information. But it did have some duplicates, and there were some, you know, interesting data questions that we still had to navigate before, you know, really diving into the analysis.
Before extrapolating. Gina, what stood out to you most of this analysis? Can you give us some, you know, takeaways of what you found?
Yeah, absolutely. So we did see that Trump is arresting more undocumented immigrants with criminal convictions. It increased by 77% under Trump compared to Biden's final 16 months. But we don't know much about these criminal convictions based on the data they shared with us. We don't know how serious the crimes were or how long ago they were. And of course, that matters because under the Lake and Riley Act that was passed under Trump, immigrants with petty theft convictions can also be detained.
Can you explain a little bit more what the Lake and Riley Act is and what it has allowed the Trump administration to do with undocumented immigrants?
I can't speak in depth on that one. Maybe Eva can.
The Lake and Riley Act, so it's based on a victim that a victim of a crime that, and the perpetrator or alleged perpetrator of the crime happened to be an immigrant. And the Lake and Riley Act asks, you know, the Department of Homeland Security to arrest immigrants who are not necessarily even charged. They could be arrested for petty thefts and, you know, some lower level crimes rather than violent felonies. And, you know, and they also allow the government to sue the Department of Homeland Security if they didn't arrest someone like this. And afterwards, that person commits a crime against an American citizen.
Okay, so it allows them to actually, you know, take in, if you will, more undocumented immigrants on petty theft or other types of crimes. Can you explain, Gina, why you started with September 2023 and ran this data through last month to look at trend lines?
That's the amount of data that we were able to have to compare. Biden and Trump, right, Eva?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Eva, you write, you know, about some of the big change was this jump in arrests of immigrants without criminal convictions, except for their immigration violation. Can you describe the scale of the increase?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the arrests under Trump are five times as many as the arrests under Biden for those who don't have any criminal records but have immigration violations. And it's important to note that the immigration violations alone, they are not a criminal arrest. None of these arrests are criminal. They are a civil offense. And, you know, the sole purpose for arresting these people would be to deport them rather than, you know, prosecute them for any crimes that they've committed.
Gina, can you bring this data into everyday life? How might this information change the circumstances for immigrants going about their lives in Milwaukee?
Well, I can see when we look at this data, we can see real people examples from Wisconsin. Like when we spoke with an immigration attorney, he called an example, Camila Munoz, who was detained by ICE while returning from her honeymoon in Puerto Rico with her U.S. citizen husband. The immigration attorney called her example a canary in the coal mine because, you know, before Trump, someone like her who has no criminal record, who is married to a U.S. citizen, and who is currently applying for a green card wouldn't be detained by ICE. So it's a local example of some escalation in Trump's immigration policies.
So a local example there of Camila Munoz of Peru, a resident of Wisconsin Dells who was arrested returning from her honeymoon with her U.S. citizen husband earlier this year. We are talking with Gina Lee Castro and Eva Wen. They're co-authors of a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel report covering the increase in immigration arrests in Wisconsin since President Trump took office earlier this year with data released from ICE. Gina, you know, what can you tell us about the scope of arrests included in this data? What did you find and how serious are the crimes?
Well, we couldn't tell. We don't know based on the data how serious these criminal convictions are, how long ago they were. And that kind of information really matters, especially when we think about the Milwaukee resident, Ramon Morales Reyes, who the Department of Homeland Security called a criminal, and he actually did have a conviction of disorderly conduct from 29 years ago, but he was arrested by ICE in May this year and accused of threatening to assassinate Trump. But the reason this accusation even came about was he was framed by the person he was actually testifying against for robbery and assault. The man was attempting to get Morales Reyes deported. But if this is one of the examples that the Department of Homeland Security is calling a criminal, like it's an older charge. He has, you know, proven that he isn't a danger to society. So it raised a lot of questions of who exactly is fitting into this broad definition of people with criminal convictions in this data.
And Eva, what changes, if any, are you seeing in data collected in much more recent months? How do your trend lines go in recent months?
So one of the biggest findings of our data is that, you know, the biggest increase is among people without criminal convictions. And that is especially the case in June, since Trump increased the arrest quota from 1,000 to 3,000, and immigration agents were told to arrest people without criminal records in order to hit that quota.
How do these arrests you're seeing in Wisconsin compare to the rest of the nation?
So it's not atypical. It follows the general trend in the nation where, you know, a lot more people without criminal convictions or without any pending charges are being arrested. It's actually even more people and a bigger increase in the western part and the southern part of the nation.
Western and southern part of the nation. What are you looking for as you follow these numbers? Are there any indications from ICE that it will continue to publish this monthly data?
Well, the data is not published by ICE. It's done through open records requests, and we are continuing to follow through with monthly open records requests to obtain the latest data. So we're looking forward to continuing to follow the trends and analyzing and bringing to readers a lot more information.
Gina, how might this particular data inform other reporting that you're doing on immigration and how it affects Wisconsinites?
Yeah, I think it will. We started this this service to our readers where we they can submit questions to us through a survey and about immigration. I think it will be able to help us provide, you know, necessary information that our readers are asking about, like wondering if immigrants are being denied bond. Like we will be able to, you know, use this data to try to see if that's accurate, seeing if it if there are more immigrants being sent out of state, being detained in ICE facilities out of state. We'll be able to see if that's accurate. So trying to answer our readers' questions thoughtfully and accurately, it will definitely help with that.
What types of questions are you asking? What would you like to pursue?
Well, what I was meaning there is people have been asking us questions through our survey, but we definitely, you know, we've been doing a lot of interviews with immigration attorneys in the state and asking them, you know, what's different from Biden's time administration to Trump's and other administrations, but seeing like what's really the escalation or difference, and then trying to verify that with the data.
Well, Eva and Gina, thank you so much for sharing your reporting with us.
Thank you for letting us talk about it.
Eva Nguyen and Gina Lee Castro, they co-authored a new report at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. It documents a sharp rise in immigration arrests since President Trump took office earlier this year. Coming up on Wisconsin Today, the White House is calling for schools to train millions of teachers and students on AI. Hear from Wisconsin Teachers of the Year.
AI can't replace the person in front of you or the forest you're in or the thing you're creating with your hands.
It doesn't replace going outside and talking about our nature trail or our solar panels or many of the other things, but it can add to them.
That's ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Earlier this year, President Trump issued an executive order calling for schools to train millions of teachers and students on artificial intelligence tools and to integrate AI into the classroom. The American Federation of Teachers announced it's creating a national AI training center for educators with $23 million in funding from Microsoft and other tech companies. On the UW-Milwaukee campus, Microsoft just opened a new AI co-innovation lab. As this technology becomes a bigger part of education, we're checking in with Wisconsin teachers on how they're navigating changes within their profession. Mark Ackerman is a science teacher at Darlington Elementary Middle School. He was named one of the Wisconsin Teachers of the Year for 2026. Mark, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Well, thank you for having me.
And Brian Councilman is a science teacher and project-based learning coordinator at Malcolm Shabazz City High School in Madison. He was named one of Wisconsin's five Teachers of the Year for 2025. Brian, thanks for being here.
Well, thanks for having me. Appreciate all you do at WPR.
Brian, do you have a firm stance on how you approach artificial intelligence for your students and how you go about in the classroom with AI?
Yeah, that is a giant question of our age, isn't it? A firm stance, I think, is hard. I think it's just actively trying to navigate the landscape that seems like with AI is changing, you know, constantly and continually. So I think as educators, we're doing a lot of learning, one, like what is capable out there. And then honestly, it's like, okay, so what does that mean for us? Like, what's kind of the catch up we can play with it? But honestly, I think if I had to put a firm stance on it, I try to be someone who's not negligent of it, working with young people, obviously, if you ignore the technology, that doesn't work. They're going to, you know, like it's going to be used. It's out there. So I think it's kind of understanding what it is. And I think for us, then I think often schools look to like, how can I find a way to regulate it? Can I find a way to stop it? And I think some of those tools can be really powerful and useful. I think for me and us at our school, we're a project-based learning school. And so I think the most effective thing I found around AI is how can we use that as a tool, like be earnest and realistic about around where that could be helpful. But then areas where we're trying to counteract how AI is being used or want students to dig in a more authentic way, how can you find those more authentic experiences? So I think for us being a project-based learning school, that's often finding those real authentic moments where students are really digging into, you know, experiencing things real time.
Because, Brian, you're known for dreaming up some really creative, really cool lesson projects. I mean, but could you try? Oh, right. But could AI do that, too?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. So, I mean, looking at it professionally, just had an interaction. We have a one staff member who's really well versed in using AI. And yeah, professionally, some of the stuff it does is great. And, you know, he used it as a way of like, hey, I'm looking for community partners in the greater Madison area. And, you know, related to a performance arts class. And it cranked out some amazing ideas and lesson plans and things. So I'm not anti that. You know, I think those are things that can generate ideas. And a lot of those tools can be really useful as a professional. And I don't get too offended if it generates ideas that are as good as the ones we as teachers create, right? But I think that's a tool in our toolbox. But also just knowing that it's not the only tool in our toolbox and that in some ways I feel like this moment in time might be helping to kind of double down on like those real experiences. And I think that's a lot of our wheelhouse and stuff we strive to do is, you know, AI can't replace the person in front of you or the forest you're in or the, you know, the thing you're creating with your hands. And so I think how can we make sure we balance this AI tech with some of these concrete real experiences for our young people too?
Mark, we might think of more advanced technology being primarily for older students, high school students, but do you see it with your fifth and sixth graders as well?
Oh, definitely. When we're talking about AI, I think we have to embrace it as an educational tool for both teachers and students, obviously. And when I think about it a lot, I think back, this is my 33rd year teaching in Wisconsin. And I think back to when the internet came out and how that was such a different thing for people to grasp and get a hold of. And AI is similar. It's a very powerful tool. But I think we need to talk to students on how to use it responsibly in the classroom. But like for my fifth and sixth graders, I love it. Basically, as a teacher, for me, it helps me generate lessons if I need to, you know, in minutes instead of hours that I can then edit to serve me and serve my students better. Information is much quicker with it. It helps me communicate with my students and coworkers at times and make me a more engaging and creative teacher, I think, as well, too. For my students, much like Brian talked about, you know, you want students to be real life learners and work with hands-on learning. And we do all of that. But at the same time, you can incorporate some of that AI into it as a tool. I mean, we all know how much students are motivated by technology. And when you can use that AI to increase that motivation and that curiosity and relate your content in that fun and engaging way, I think it makes learning basically a very exciting thing for students. And they want to do it, especially at my fifth and sixth grade level. Now, like Brian said, too, it doesn't replace going outside and talking about our nature trail or our solar panels or many of the other things, but it can add to them. It can add to our learning. And for me, the goal is to help my learners become thoughtful, creative thinkers that can solve problems. And AI can really add to that, I believe.
I understand that your principal has also started an AI committee at your school. What kind of guidance, what kind of support have you received from administrators on like implementing the technology or, you know, incorporating it into your classroom?
Yeah, my principal, Mike Flanagan, does an awesome job. He's kind of at the forefront of everything, really. And last year he developed or started an AI committee, and I'm on that AI committee. And what he wanted to do was to focus basically on how to best use AI in our school for both teachers and students here at Garlington. And basically, what I kind of did as my part to help out is I developed a CuriPod, which is, I'll get into that in a little bit, but it's a cool AI tool But I developed one to help the staff and students basically learn a little bit more about AI and how we can use it.
Did you say CurePod or CarePod? CurePod.
It's CURIPOD. It's a program that it's basically an app. But we've basically bought that program to use this year. I used it several times last year, the free version of it. And what it does is it allows me to take a subject we're doing, like in my science room, and I can put in some concepts I want the kids to learn about. It'll create the lesson plan, but then it makes it interactive for the students. So it's really cool. And the kids absolutely love it. Something like that would take me hours to come up with on my own. And it does it basically in a minute, but then I can edit it to make it more applicable. And the thing I love about it is students then, when they give like a written response, it will basically analyze that written response and it'll tell them, hey, you know, you could add in more detail here, or grammar wise, you could have done this, and it makes them better writers. And it tells them what they did well, too.
That is Mark Ackerman at Darlington Elementary Middle School. And Brian Councilman is here at Malcolm Shabazz City High School in Madison as we talk about artificial intelligence in the classroom. And these teachers are two recent Wisconsin Teachers of the Year. Brian, when students aren't in the classroom, they can go home, they can access AI for whatever they want, day or night. How does that impact the way you approach teaching and assignments for students?
Yeah, I think when you look at things like homework or assignments, in some ways, I think it challenges teachers in a really healthy way. You know, I think we could sit there and be like, oh, they can just look it up, or they can create this thing, and it's like the AI is doing it for them. Even think about research is a big one. Like when you're researching, mm-hmm. Now it's kind of forced our hand of the first thing that pops up on a Google search, right, is the AI generated research tool. And so one, I think it's helping students understand what's happening when they're accessing that, if they're going to, you know, use Google to look into something they're working on at home or during class. You know, how they're maybe looking at more primary sources and just the value that might have. Not that it's like a got you, like AI is bad, but also like just know that this is being generated from these other independent sources. And then, I mean, earnestly, as a alternative high school, we often have very limited homework to begin with. And so for us, that maybe is less of a concern. And part of our ethos in that is we have a lot of students that have a lot going on in their lives at home and needing to focus on that, want them to have rich lives outside of school and also work through some of the things that might be tough for them. But even given some of the homework and things they might do, I think it's how can we think about, we use this term like depth of knowledge, and it's kind of this thing, as Mark talked about, like the advent of the internet, right? Like it kind of progresses from like the what of a fact to like the how, and then the why is like a level three, and then the how else do we use it, right? And I think, So for us, when I think of assignments, I think, you know, the what and the how are really easy with just internet AI, certainly now, right? It blows it out of the water. But how are we getting into those like whys and how else's? As well as reflection. So I do a ton of reflection stuff. And I think that's a great way to get students that, sure, you can look something up. You can look up a fact. You can create a product using this AI tool. But what the AI tool can't do is reflect on how you engaged with an experience in class or outside of class.
Mark, what comes up for you on this idea of cheating and assessments and pivoting? What are you thinking about?
I couldn't agree more with Brian. And a lot of the concepts he brought up was exactly what I was going to say. I don't give much homework either at the fifth and sixth grade level. I agree with Brian that the kids have so much going on anymore in their lives. And to me, learning, it should be something that's done mostly in the classroom. You know, that exploration, that creativity, that collaboration that can happen in the classroom. And AI can provide all of that in the classroom. And as far as like, when I do give it something, like he said, it's reflective. It's tied to a real world observation, something that AI can't do for them, basically. And I think, like he said, Brian said, you know, your goal is not to catch students cheating. You would hope they don't. But I think if we can keep that stuff in the classroom more so, we have tools like GoGuardian and other things to monitor them when they're in the classroom. But learning is something basically to me and to Brian, it sounds like too, we're exploring, we're creating, we're looking at real life things. And, if we don't give much homework, you don't have to deal with that a lot as well either.
So you saw the dawn of the information superhighway, internet starting to be incorporated, Mark, into the classroom, waiting for web pages to come up. And then we see this month, you know, Microsoft planning to give more than $4 billion in funding and technology services to train people in the education setting with AI tools. I wonder, how do you feel about this intensive push from Silicon Valley to get chatbots into class?
That's a great question. Again, I'm learning about this stuff just like you are and everybody else, teachers all around the United States are. You know, I'm always interested in learning about some of the stuff that they have to offer, and I'm always willing to take a look at it. And until I really look at it myself and learn more about it, it's really hard to comment on some of that stuff that they're coming out with. But in my classroom, I mean, technology, you know, it makes students so much more engaged. And if we can figure out how to use, you know, think about cell phones and how they replace desktops and computers for many people in today's society. And as a teacher, technology has always allowed me to become more creative, a more engaging teacher. And I compare AI to when the internet came out. It just opened up so many areas for advancement in how we teach and how we learn. And I think AI is doing the same thing. It's just that we have to figure out how we can incorporate it with still doing many of the other things that are important for students to learn.
Brian, how do you strike that balance of seeing all of these technology services and new tools from these companies, big tech, you know, kind of moving more closely into the education sector, especially now, you know, really focused on AI? How do you parse all of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I tend to be more of an inherent skeptic of technology. You can ask my wife. I'm often like, well, I'll give it a minute. Let's, you know, but being I have a many generations old, you know, technology and cell phones, but it's also being a teacher, right? You're wading in the waters with students and they have the stuff, right? And so, I think it is this striking this balance of how can we soak it in, like kind of see what's available. And yeah, I think, you know, I think Mark brought up like the cell phone argument, and that's a challenging one as well. And I think with all these technologies, it's like, how can I as a teacher use those as a way to be like a litmus of what we're doing and enhance it, but not fall into what feels like a trap to me of just like jumping in and having everything live there. I mean, even now, just like Google Classroom and high school classrooms, like holy buckets, like it's kind of everything, which in some ways is great. It's a great organizational tool, but I think some ways like, well, a good litmus test as a teacher, like if Google Classroom crashes, like what do you got? You know, and I think making sure you got something still, right? And
something
I think
in your back pocket.
Yeah, it's like something that's AI, right? And I think if you have nothing, if you're like, oh my gosh, Google Classroom, the internet's out today. Like, no, like I love it when the internet's out. Actually, it's one of my favorite days. I'm like, okay, what's everyone going to do? And you know, it's just like a great like professional test of like, what do you got in your toolkit, right? And I think as long as teachers got something in their toolkit, like it's fine, right? But if you don't, like, well, that's maybe something to think critically about of like, okay, what is my next step if all of a sudden this technology is gone, right? And so that's kind of one of the things I think about professionally as I kind of navigate it. And then, you know, how can I use it as, you know, maybe something like, cell phones is a constant battle with high school, right? Kids have them all the time and they're so ubiquitous. And they, again, for many students, they do work better on cell phones. Like, how do you navigate that time? Like, when is it appropriate? How do you build those expectations and rules? And I laugh that we do so much like experiential stuff and things that I hope I kind of talk about, like, is it something you're going to tell a story about later? And for young people, if they're going to tell a story about it, they want to take a picture of it, right? And so we'll often use it. Sometimes it's like, okay, I'm on to something. If students are like, can I take a picture of that? I'm like, okay, we might be doing something worthy of like a Snapchat or something instead of fighting that, right? And being like, no, you can't take a picture, put that phone away. So, I mean, I think it's like kind of finding those places to push as a teacher and then those places to be like, you know what, actually, like they're just utilizing this tool in a way that's normal for a young person and they're excited. And like, and then if you can strike that balance with students and they know that like, I'm not here to police your technology use per se, right? But I'm also here to help you realize that there's a whole breadth of world experience. And if technology is a piece of that, and for some people, it's more or less a piece of that, sometimes it can be an interesting litmus tool. So I think for me, again, it's just like making sure that AI, and as this pushes in, there's more and more pressure for it, making sure it's just like an arrow in our quiver, not the whole kit and caboodle. So that's kind of my litmus test as I kind of digest all the new stuff as it's kind of this tidal wave of new information and technology. So,
Mark, I'm thinking about the one thing in your toolbox that includes founding a few decades ago, founding a nature trail in Darlington, you know, a space for outdoor learning. What kind of things can the natural world teach us that technology just can't replicate?
Well, that's a great question. I'm really proud of all the sustainability efforts we've done here at Darlington over my 33 years. The nature trail is just one of the things that we have here. We have over 30 some trees on a nature trail. We're getting 7 more this year. And one of the cool things about the nature trail is that each time a teacher retires from our school district, they're given the tree on the nature trail for their dedication for their years of service here, and provides though a place for the kids to go out and do leaf collections and get outside and enjoy nature. There's so many things we can go out there and do, and we do that on a constant basis. So that's something that AI can't provide. And we also have here at our school, we have solar panels on top of the school. So as a science teacher, I love that. We can go up and take a look at the solar panels and talk a little bit about how that electricity is generated from those solar panels. We also have one of the things that I did with some of the money that I was given from the Cole Foundation is we're going to actually use that to build like a little astronomy station outside. And we're going to have the kids come in at night so we can take a look at the stars and the universe. And another thing that I'm actually doing with that money as well, too, is we're going to put in a composter for our school's lunch scraps so we can use that and use that actual composted material then to when we plant the new trees and stuff. So that'll go right back on the nature trail. So there's so many things in the science room, obviously, that are hands on and real life things that we incorporate here at Darlington that it's really, really cool. And AI obviously can't do those things, but you can use AI to connect to those things and learn more about the things. That's the beauty of kind of finding the balance between the two.
Well, Brian and Mark, thank you so much for this conversation. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Thank you so much.
Brian Kunzelman is a science teacher and project-based learning coordinator at Malcolm Shabazz City High School in Madison. And Mark Ackerman is a 5th and 6th grade science teacher at Darlington Elementary Middle School. They are with us to share how teachers are managing AI in the classroom and how the job of teaching has changed with new technologies. Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, the challenges in upgrading county emergency warning systems in the state and how two counties want to reduce so-called siren fatigue.
I wish people would take the pre-planning more seriously in the blue sky days, because you just never know when something terrible might happen.
That's next from WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Rock County Emergency Management is asking for roughly $500,000 in the county budget to modernize its tornado warning sirens to a more localized system. The move faces funding challenges, but if approved, it would link local tornado sirens with National Weather Service tornado warnings. Several counties across the state have already adopted the new tornado sirens. The earlier and more local a warning can be, even by minutes, can save lives and let people know to seek shelter. Kevin Wernett directs Rock County Emergency Management. Paula Vandeligraf directs Outagamie County Emergency Management. And they spoke recently with WPR's Lee Rayburn.
Paula, let's start with you and how the current outdoor siren alert system in Outagamie County works. How does it operate and when does it set off?
So the sirens in Outagamie County will only go off when the National Weather Service issues a tornado warning or a trained spotter, law enforcement, fire department member spots a funnel cloud. Then the sirens can be manually activated by either the 911 center or for members of the emergency management department. But the automated siren activation occurs when the National Weather Service issues that warning, so we don't have to involve ourselves at all at that point.
Kevin, what's the current state of the outdoor siren alert system in Rock County?
A little bit different. Our sirens sound for tornado warnings, or if there's a destructive tag issued for a severe thunderstorm warning. And what that destructive tag is associated with is 80 mile an hour winds or baseball size hail. So either of those scenarios, if the National Weather Service issues those warnings, it comes in on a fax. We over at 911, they grab that printed paper, they confirm it's for Rock County, and then they should sound the sirens. We can also sound them if we have reported from a trained weather spotter or police or fire personnel, that there's a funnel. They can manually override the system and sound it. When they do sound, it's all the sirens sound at the same time. There's an on button and off button over at 911, and there's one here in emergency management as well.
Kevin, you're proposing a new siren system for Rock County in their upcoming budget. Tell us a little bit about what you'd like to see change and what the timeline could be in implementation here.
Well, I'll do the timeline first. The timeline is really going to be dependent on available funds in the budget and the budget approval. The changes, what they would do is all 41 sirens in the county are, most of our sirens in Rock County are around populated areas or some of the outdoor recreational areas. We don't have full coverage, but all those sirens are controlled. And so if there's a warning in, say, the northwest portion of the county near Evansville, all 41 of those sirens, including miles away in Clinton with no hazard, potentially, sound. And so that confuses the public sometimes. They're hearing the sirens, but not in the warned area or that risk area. And so this proposed change would allow us to tie the sirens sounding to the zone of the warning or that polygon that the National Weather Service has developed as that hazard area. Some of our neighbors sound them with, if there's a siren within a mile and a half of the hazard area, those would automatically sound. So this new system really takes away that fax, the paper, the pushing the button component with the delays that are inherent there, and automates it with that warning box from the National Weather Service. And it ties it to that area of the warning. So less siren fatigue in those areas that aren't under risk. And what it also does is it gives us feedback that those sirens sounded. Right now, if I'm sitting over at 911 with those folks, you have to, on a quiet day, you can hear it. If it's raining heavy, you got to step out of the door to make sure that that button worked to hear the siren. So that's an important piece of this. It would give us instant feedback that those sirens were operational and allow us to use it for a few other things as well. So the proposal also would add batteries to each one of those sirens. Right now, if the power's out, the sirens are out. And this would put a battery backup and put them on that DC power source so that they function even if the power was out from the first storm as that second one came through.
How receptive have Rock County leaders been to your request for this upgrade in the siren system?
I would say generally, the folks I've talked to are very open to this. The big barrier really is the price tag. And adding that component, obviously there's an expense.
What's the price tag?
Our estimates in initial estimates have been about $500,000 to upgrade the sirens with the cell primary radio backup and add that DC power source. And that's one other thing. If the radio system's down, the sirens are down as well. And so this would give us a redundant system, two ways to sound the sirens instead of just that one.
And Paula, as you mentioned, Outagamie County sirens already operate locally and automatically send out warnings when they happen through the National Weather Service. How is this system serving the residents of Outagamie County as you see it? Has it been effective?
I think yes, definitely. Because of the reasons Kevin already just mentioned, right now our sirens will only activate in that warning area that the National Weather Service issues. So for instance, on Wednesday, the village of Bear Creek was under a tornado warning. So their siren was the only one of the 44 sirens we have in our county that activated because they were the only one that was affected by the tornado warning. So yes, it alleviates that blue sky siren going off and people wondering why. And then also that does create that confusion of, well, the sirens are always going off. How do we know when it's real and when it's not? So when the sirens are going off in your neighborhood, it should be because
it's real.
There is a severe weather threat at this current moment. So, you know, it's definitely a huge benefit to the communities. And I think along with what Kevin said, you know, we get a report back as well. So we know every day when we test them silently, the radio to radio communication, that if there's an issue, we can locate or we can notify those local representatives and have them send out a technician to fix the sirens. Or with the battery backups, we have those on all the sirens and some might even be put set up to generator power. So yes, we have a little window where if the sirens need to activate without power, they will activate, I believe, up to 2 times on that battery backup. If it needs to go off a third time, they may not work because the batteries just can't hold the power that long.
We're talking about tornado warning sirens with Paula Vanilligraf, Outagamie County Emergency Management Director, and Kevin Wernette, Rock County Emergency Management Director, looking at a proposal for Rock County to upgrade their system and make it more localized. But Paula, Rock County also has sends out outdoor sirens for, Kevin mentioned, the destructive tag during severe storm warnings. Is that something that could be implemented in Outagamie County? It seems like we're seeing stronger winds beyond just tornadoes these days.
Absolutely. We've definitely had those conversations. And I believe that destructive tag is relatively new with the National Weather Service. So we had started the conversation, I believe, last summer about maybe including that into our activation software. Right now, it only picks up on the tornado warning, so we would have to work with National Weather Service and our vendor to see if there's something that the vendor's software would catch to automatically set off those sirens. Right now, there's a 3-digit code. I believe it's TOR for tornado. When our system sees that code, it activates the necessary sirens. I don't know if they have a tag for that destructive code, and that might be the one thing that's hung us up so far.
The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports county budgets could be at risk from the federal government's cuts to a number of grant programs. And Kevin, it makes me wonder what impact this budget challenge could have on your proposed upgrade to the Rock County tornado sirens.
Well, we're always have been really concerned about that emergency management performance grant that we receive. And that makes up about 17% of the emergency management budget and about 12% of the overall budget, if I did the numbers right. So that is a threat. And obviously with the delay implementation, as we have to look and prioritize the different parts of the program, and there's other cuts to other county departments. And that is always puts us in a position where, folks got to make tough decisions and priorities. We'll make the ask. And I'm asked for policy guidance from the board.
Paula, Outagamie County has a program that delivers free weather radios for some residents each year. What is the future of that program considering proposed funding cuts?
Yeah, that is one that people look forward to every year. And we work very closely with our vulnerable populations to make sure that they have the tools they need in order to seek shelter, because like Kevin said earlier too, sirens, number one, don't cover our entire county. We have a lot of areas that have no siren coverage. And number two, sirens are really meant to be heard outdoors. That they're not meant to wake you up out of your sleep in the middle of a storm. So having those extra tools like a weather radio are really important because those, can wake you up while you're sleeping. They're inside your home. They're very loud. They give you exact wording on what actionable tasks people should take. So that is one of the things that we do get through our county budget. In my operational budget is money for weather radios, and then we hand those out to those vulnerable populations. We've had that program for probably 6-7 years now, and it's great. I think we give out approximately 900 radios a year.
Wow.
But that would be one of the things that if I was told my numbers needed to come down, that would be one program I would probably have to cut because it is a fairly decent amount of money in my budget.
4th of July, over 130 people died in Kerr County, Texas, after extreme flash flooding. PBS has reported that the county, Kerr County, had previously looked to modernize its early warning system, but did not do so in time. Kevin, I'm wondering what your takeaways are from stories like these from the perspective of an emergency management director.
Well, I've seen the media reporting, but I have not read their after-action report. We'll be taking a look at that. And those unfortunate events are difficult, right? Because they have just such an impact on lives and entire communities. And so I think all of my peers are really pushed to make sure that we can alert the public. They have a plan and folks are prepared. And, we had looked at some of the weather events from last year, that we had. We looked at some of the weather events that were occurring in the south, and that really drove home not just our experience here, but some of those other experiences, including those like Texas, that it's important to maintain that system of warning and promote the weather radios, the outdoor warning sirens, make sure that they're well maintained and able to alert the public, and the folks have a plan. So I would ask if listeners out there don't live right underneath an outdoor warning sign, they have a weather radio, and have a plan on where they can go to have that safe place, whether it's a tornado, a flood, or another severe incident.
Paula, what keeps you up at night as a director of emergency management?
You know, things like what happened down in Texas are terrifying and, you know, so very sad. And sometimes I think that the only, you know, that's when people actually look to our offices as being valuable is after something terrible like that happens. So, I mean, it's not necessarily that it keeps me up, but it's just I wish people would take the pre-planning more seriously in the blue sky days, because you just never know when something terrible might happen. And if you've practiced these things, if you know where your safe spots are, or you have a communication plan in place, you know, you may just be able to bounce back and survive easier than maybe somebody who didn't plan. And that's very unfortunate, but that's just, you know, something that we preach, and we just wish that people would find value in what we do every day, so that they can save their own lives and take some, you know, personal accountability and pride in the fact that they are preparing their family for the worst. You know, one other thing that maybe I would mention is just, you know, part of that preparedness is just as simple as every morning getting up and checking the weather. It takes less than a minute. You know, log into your local weather app, check the forecast. If they are calling for a chance of anything severe, you know, maybe you adjust your plans, or you're just more vigilant throughout the day. You know, it just makes you more aware. So you can adjust those plans. So if you've got small children at home, maybe while you're at work during the summer, you can give them a heads up before you leave the house, you know, for them to just be safe also. So I think making just weather planning part of your daily routine is so important.
Paula, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And Kevin, thanks to you.
Thank you.
That is Kevin Wernett, who directs Rock County Emergency Management in South Central Wisconsin along the Illinois border, and Paula Vandelei-Graff, who directs Outagamie County Emergency Management in the Fox Cities region. They spoke with WPR's Lee Rayburn about modernizing county tornado siren systems and local warnings for weather emergencies. There are federal regulatory changes coming to the trucking industry, and on Thursday, we'll hear two perspectives in Wisconsin on the business of moving freight and what these changes could mean to companies here in our state. Maybe you're a long-haul truck driver. Let's hear your thoughts on business now and how your days have changed behind the wheel of your rig. What challenges do you face? What changes do you want to see in your industry? Or maybe you drive on the highway and the interstates a lot and pass large trucks. Give us your take and share your stories. We'd like to incorporate them into a future program. Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text to get in touch with us at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Avery Lee Rogers, Lauren Cox, and Royce Padeswa. Our technical directors are Jeff Robbins and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to WPR News.